K.K. Downing formed Judas Priest in 1969 and climbed to the top of the hard rock and heavy metal world, where they served as kings of the mountain for 40-plus years before he retired in 2010. His long-awaited autobiography is finally here. K.K. Downing's book is called Heavy Duty, Days and Nights in Judas Priest. It's out September 18th on DeCapo Press. Now, September 18th, I would imagine by the time this episode airs, it will be after September 18th. So that means the book will be available. No excuses. Go out and get yourself a copy. K.K. is in this episode talking at length about his book. I just want to put that aside for 1 second. I want to talk about Retrospeak. Patrick Ivanitsky, my co-host here at Rock Under Fire, we talked back in May and we addressed the situation with this show, and we decided we were going to take a little bit of a break, and we're putting together our sister podcast. Now, if you love nostalgia, if you love the 20th century, all of the foundation and beginnings of the modern age, and you know, we know some of that goes back even into the, I guess, pre-industrial age, you know, going back into the mid-19th century. Yeah, that's all well and good. But you know what? Most of the stuff we're going to do is in the 20th century. And, you know, we're going to go through history and pop culture and music and movies and books, art, science, sports, technology, the whole trip. And that's going to start on October 1st. You'll find us on iTunes. You won't find us now on iTunes, but if it's after October 1st, you'll find us on iTunes. In the meantime, go to our YouTube channel, Retrospeak. Our YouTube channel, subscribe. It's free. Doesn't hurt. You just got to hit subscribe. Like us on Facebook, too. You know, that's another place you could find us. A lot of fun things on our Facebook page. Not going to be quite exactly what the episodes are going to be, because the podcast and the Facebook page are kind of two different sides of what we do. The Facebook page is, I guess, is going to be more of a fun thing, audience participation type of posts and threads, while the podcast episodes are going to be a little bit more discussion based, more a little bit more, I don't know, cerebral, academic, for a lack of a better word. Hope that doesn't sound too artsy fartsy or too elitist or anything like that, because it really is going to be a fun fly-on-the-wall experience, as if you're eavesdropping on, you know, two geeks conversation about any number of topics. So now we get to talk about everything else. Retrospeak starts October 1st. Anyway, K.K. Downing, got a chance to talk to him about his book at length. We were supposed to talk 20 minutes because he's doing a lot of press, and there's been a lot of press releasing, you know, some of it is just some of those headlines, man. They really milk these interviews for as many headlines as they could get. So if he says one sentence, you'll see it the next day in a headline, and there'll be an entire article based on that one sentence. And then they'll take another sentence and make a headline out of it and then build an entire article. And a lot of these publications, these metal publications, I'm not going to name names. You know who they are. Hey, they're a lot more successful than we are. They have a lot more hits. They have a lot more followers. A lot more people know about them than they know about me. Trust me, I'm not saying no. But you know what? This is what they do. And they will milk an interview for 2 or 3 weeks at a time. And that's what they do. They take one line of an interview and then they build an entire article about it. You know, when you could just read the whole damn thing somewhere else. Okay, so anyway, my conversation with KK was, it went an hour. We were supposed to talk 20 minutes, and we talked for an hour. He was feeling very talkative, and I think he connected with the fact that I was a fan, and we do go back, and there was that. I think that an interview turns more into a conversation when you know your stuff, and I think he picks up on that. I think anybody, for that matter, will really pick up on the fact that the person asking them questions, once they get into conversational mode, they tend to relax a little bit more. And I think that's what happened with KK. And We didn't get to talk. Here's the problem with this thing, and this is the last thing I'll say, like Eddie Trunk. And here's the last thing I'll say about this. We were supposed to talk about so many other things, and sometimes interviews don't always go according to plan. So you just have to improvise and just, you know, pick up exactly how the last sentence leaves off. So I'm thinking we're only going to get 20 minutes and I'm going to rush all of this stuff. How am I going to fit all this stuff into 20 minutes? And KK knew that, and I kind of expressed that. And those things, you know, that little part of the discussion got cut. I didn't see any real need to put that, throw that in here and make you listen to that. We ended up talking for an hour, and then it got to the point where we both got so relaxed that we were just talking and talking and talking about it, that I forgot that it was an interview and that there was going to be time constraints at some point. And then he had to go, and we really didn't get into talking about things like the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But, you know, that's neither here nor there, because it's been back and forth in the press. The whole thing about him and his former band members, back and forth in the press. All the bickering going on. It's well documented at this point. I don't need to rehash that. Anyway, this is from September 5th, I guess 2 weeks ago. This is me and KK Downing of Judas Priest.
What's up, Mike?
KK.
How are you doing, buddy?
How are you? I am well.
I'm all right, Mike. What? Yeah.
Great, great. So how are you doing, man?
I'm good, man. I was just trying to think. Area code 732. I'm trying to guess where you are.
Do you want to take a guess, or should I just tell you?
732. I don't really know. I've got to be honest.
That is a New Jersey area code. I'm in Central Jersey.
I should have known.
I go back with you to, you know, I'm 48, so I'm just going to date myself. So I go back with you guys to the Vengeance Tour. Anytime you were at the Meadowlands, you and me were in the same room.
Yeah.
And, you know, the infamous Garden Show, the seat cushion show.
Yeah, were you there?
I was there. I did an article on that show a couple months ago. Yeah, they thanked you guys for the new seats, though, a little shortly after that when you guys were watching tennis, I believe.
That's exactly right, yes.
Well, anyway, Lisa told me that I was your last call for today, and she said that that could be good news or bad news, in a sense that, you know, you could be tired and not want to talk, or else you might want to talk a little bit longer. She said I have about 20 minutes to maybe a half hour.
Yeah.
So you good with that?
I think she got here. I'm speaking to someone at 6 o'clock, so well, that means we've got plenty of time anyway, mate.
Okay, that sounds good. So anyway, first off, congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you very much.
How long has this been with you, man? Like, how was this an idea that you carried around since wanting to leave the band, or was it something that you decided on doing in recent years?
Yeah, no, I never had any aspirations to do anything on my own, really. You know, when I was in the band, obviously the band was the primary focus all of the time for me, you know, but lots of people had asked me, especially since I quit the band, that but I never had any inclination to do anything. And then last year I was asked, and I thought, well, maybe now's the time, really, you know, to say my, you know, my piece, and to try and bring an insight into my life, really, and hopefully a lot of people can relate to the journey. You know, starts off, you know, I'm not the only one, I know that. I've been around a lot of people had a rough upbringing, and a lot of people did well, other people not so well. And I just tell my story about pretty much how music came into my life, really, and it was a saving grace, really. It put me on a path, and I never steered from the path, really. So it's quite an amazing story, I think.
And as far as that story, I mean, it really is a KK Downing book. I mean, you could define it as, you know, it's a Judas Priest book, in the sense that it's, you know, it's the first major publication from anyone in your band. So that is a major thing. But it really is, first and foremost, your story. You hear about people who tend to block things out, you know, like entire chunks of the past, you know, and then it all comes to the surface years later, and people struggle to navigate through that. And the things that you recount in the book, your reasons for doing what you do, handling situations the way you do, you know, the passive, non-confrontational personality, all attributed to maybe the first decade and a half of your life. Mm-hmm. Were these realizations that you consciously always had about yourself, or was it more like, you know, just like shit that you buried and all came up as little revelations as you were writing the book?
Yeah, I think, you know, my upbringing was, you know, I mean, I'm far from being a psychoanalyst, and it's hard for me to figure it out, but, you know, as a child, I didn't have a voice, you know. You know, you weren't allowed to have a voice. And I think that really the first, as you quite rightly said, probably the first 15 years or so of your life, it kind of molds your personality and your character. And I learned to be tolerant, yeah. You know, and deal with things just in my own mind. And you know, there's a lot of good values there. It gave me, I had endurance, I was tolerant, I was, you know, and I think that in a band, the makeup, having said that, I think the point I'm trying to make is it took me a lot to be pushed over the edge. But once I was pushed over the edge, then I would let loose, really, and let rip. But it took a lot, you know, and I think you need that in a band. You've got, well, in any relationship, you know, to make it work, you have to have levels of tolerance to let people do a lot of things that you don't necessarily agree with, you know, right. But not to say that it's wrong, you know, because you can't restrict people. And even though I've been subjected to a lot of that growing up, I learned that everybody does things differently. There's no specific right or wrong, but you have to cut people a lot of slack. And I felt that I went through life, really. And I think that I give people a lot more slack than they ever gave me, really. You know, so there was an imbalance there, but it kind of worked, you know. It kind of did work. I guess I was a bit kind of, I don't know, a bit like a comparison to like a preacher would have more tolerance to people doing naughty things, maybe, you know. I think there's a lot of that goes on in the world, yeah. You know, in the hope that people will find out for themselves that they're unjust and they're doing things wrong and they, you know, they're being unfair. You give people a chance to find out themselves rather than when I was a kid, you know, you get a swipe around the head or something. The very second you do something, and you're just learning, and because you find out that we're all learning, you know, through life. But later on, as the decades went past, I'm thinking, you know, people should know the difference between right and wrong, and people should know the difference between being fair and being unfair. And it starts to bring things to a boiling point a lot quicker than it did in previous years, you know.
Right. You know, I can totally relate to the, especially without giving too much of the book away, you know, because we want people to go out and buy the book, relating to your dad and the OCD, the obsessive compulsive disorder, not nearly as severe, but in some small way I could relate to that, you know.
Yeah, and, I think that's one of the, because when I agreed to write a book, I didn't really know what I was getting myself into, or, you know, I mean, would the book all be about me and my life and everything, you know, or, you know, I didn't know exactly how it was going to be, but I was certainly wanted to document my unorthodox childhood, really, and bring an insight out, especially to people in other countries, what it would be like, you know, in that dull climate, you know, in the 50s in England, you know, not just after the war had finished, really, you know, growing up as a little kid and what you had to go through. And I just thought it might be a good insight into the local territory that now is considered very much the home of rock and metal, you know. You know, in the Birmingham area, obviously the industrial area. Right. So I thought that might be interesting to people, but also in the way that I coped and dealt with everything and but try to look to getting out of the gutter, getting out of the industry, getting out of the dirt and the grime, you know, and getting out of that impoverishment.
The black country.
And, yeah, and at the very first opportunity, I guess consciously or subconsciously thought to myself that I'm going to do something, and I don't know what it is, but I'm going to get out of all this, and I'm going to get into something that was, you know, and I tell in the book how I looked to maybe cookery and going to college, maybe as an apprentice chef and stuff like that. So that is, because food is an art and it's a science as well. And I thought that was good, you know, because I was frustrated that, you know, at school they took away my music lessons and and my art lessons and my language lessons. And they replaced them with, like, metalwork and woodwork and religious instruction.
Right, right.
All the stuff I had no interest at all. I'm thinking I'm not going to do this, and that's what I thought. I know I'm going to do. Bit of forward thinking as a 13-year-old. I'm going to take cookery with the girls. And they couldn't stop me. I had a right to apply to take domestic science with the girls. You know, and I didn't care. I thought... I didn't care. I'm thinking this is a better way forward.
Sure.
You know, it's warm. You know, there's food about. There's girls about. I'll take the flak off the other lads. I don't care.
So what the heck did you mean then in 1984 when I'm paraphrasing, I was reading an interview with Ben, I was 14 years old going through Guitar World magazine, and somebody asked you what the biggest regret of your life was, and you said, and tell me if I'm, you know, if you remember this or not, or if you agree or disagree, but your answer was that you said, I wasted a lot of time. This doesn't seem like time wasted, man. I mean, you know, as far as like even getting out of there and forming Priest and then going from a steady upward climb into popularity, man. I mean, the arc of Judas Priest was just continuously upwards. So, I mean, what were you referring to, if you even remember the quote?
I wish I could have started playing, you know, at a younger age, really, you know.
Yeah.
And I probably was referring to that, really. And even when I started playing, I wish I'd have played more, you know, but I was having to hold down jobs and do all that stuff. I felt I was behind, you know. I felt I was behind. Like now, you get lots of great players and they're just like, you're very, very young, you know. But I kind of got there in the end, I guess.
Absolutely, man. You know, some of the parts of the book, some are surprising, some are not so surprising. And what wasn't surprising is the fact that Judas Priest, this band that you started and made history with, never saw any money from those first two records on the Gold label. And I was kind of like, well, you know, that's shocking, but not surprising, because you hear about, you know, the realities of publishing. And was that a result of you guys walking away from that contract in order to sign with Columbia, or was it?
Yeah, it was that, really, because we were signed to that small company, you know, and it was a stepping stone.
And you had to do it.
You know? Yeah.
There was like no other way around it.
We'd made a couple of records, and we felt that we were doing okay. We felt we were doing all right, and we thought that we could progress, but we didn't have any money to live on. That was the problem. I mean, the company had got us tied down pretty much with, you know, income and royalties, and the budgets to do an album were very, very low. And we were able to get gigs, and we were able to write songs, and we were able to record. But after the second album, we felt that we were being restricted because we had to try and survive and make money for ourselves, that we weren't able to jump in a van and go to a gig, and we weren't able to songwrite and do things in the daytime. So we went into the record company and said, can you give us some money to live on, you know? And back then, I think we were asking for £25 each per week, you know, just a nominal sum, really, so that we could continue to hone our skills and go out there and promote the band and promote the product. And that was turned down. So we said, there's got to be other companies out there that would be interested. So we did a showcase performance just in a room for back then, which was CBS, Sony, I guess. And they said, yeah, we'll find a band. So we walked away from our original contract, which could have gone into litigation. But
you did the right thing, man.
Yeah, we just kept that. We let them keep all the spoils, you know, all the money. I mean, there were regrets because those first two albums got revamped and got sold here and sold there. I just felt for the fans, really, that were buying the same product, just in a different cover, you know. But it is where it is. But since we signed with the Sony organization, you know, it really helped a lot, really, and they did support the band, and they still do today.
I have to tell you, that part really stuck out with me because it answered a lot of childhood questions I had. Because, you know, it just explains a lot of those the two compilations, which I will not name, but you know what I'm talking about. And some of the things that, you know, like I kind of wondered, you know, why certain things, nothing was on Metalworks other than the live version of Victim of Changes. And that was basically what you guys would have basically had to license your own material. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Yeah, you put that together. I guess that makes that's a commercial sense, right? It's one of those things.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous, you know? Huh?
I mean, we did feel somewhat aggrieved, really, because that record company, we felt we had a value. They made the mistake in not seeing that value to take care of us. So we had to go to a better home.
Yeah.
And it was a much, much, much better home.
You know, it's almost like a lot of these smaller labels, you know, they don't realize what they're taking on, especially when they strike lightning, you know, or gold, and they get something much that's so big that they can no longer contain it. It's like VJ Records had the same thing almost happen with the Beatles, you know, where they just cannot support the band in a capacity that they need to be supported. And you know what?
Yeah.
Listen, you guys did the right thing, but I want to ask you. You turn out to be the culprit who instigates the whole leather and studs thing, which inevitably becomes the defining image of heavy metal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you guys, you know, especially you and Rob, we seem to be all about the fashion. You know, you mentioned that period of, you know, the identity crisis where, you know, you're wearing all of these flowing and flamboyant clothes, especially you and Rob, you know. If you look at some of that footage of Rob in Japan in 78, which, you know, is on YouTube, he looked more like, you know, like David Bowie, and that whole, that whole period.
Yeah. And that's when, you know, it was better to begin with, really. Then it kind of got a little bit out of hand, and I just thought that it was never what I had in mind, because I was always a metal merchant. You know, it was in there always somewhere, because like I say, as a youngster, seeing and acknowledging that something in music, some things that people were doing that drew me to it, obviously, when I first saw Hendrix in 67. But even before that, when I heard the Kinks in 65, 66, 65 maybe, playing You Really Got Me, that was good for me, you know. I liked that. And when I heard, as I say, the Barry McGuire, the protest song, there was something dark about that. And then very, very early Rolling Stones, I liked the way they looked, you know, eclectic and kind of not prim and proper, almost a bit scruffy and a bit more street, you know. And then when I saw Hendrix open up with Foxy Lady and Purple Haze, I'm thinking, this is a different style of music to what I've heard, you know. And it was always there, lying inside me. And that's why when I first started, you know, with Al Atkins and all of those guys in the late 60s, you know, we wrote our own songs, you know, that were, most of them were on the first album. It was all about trying to be create and put something down that was in my mind, that was not blues, you know, not rock, not pop, not jazz, not any genre of music. It was always, you know, trying to go along. But and we did our own thing, and it was good, and it was fine. But, you know, then we started to progress the music with Sad Wings, Sin After Sin, and all of this stuff, and there was a mismatch, really, with the band's image. So something had to change, you know, and then it kind of clicked, you know, with me, that it had to be different, you know, and that would have been mid-70s sometime, you know, 76 maybe.
Yeah,
but
you know,
I did a U-turn, went totally black, had some leather stuff made, you know, wore a choker, you know, the belt appeared, and I thought to myself, this is strong, it needs to be where it's at, and I felt sure that the band would take to it, you know. And as I say in the book, when I spoke to Rob about going to that place, leather shop in London, which was run by a couple of gay guys, Rob was rustic, he loved the whole experience. and you know, and I slowly took to that, and that was good, you know, that was good. And then by the time, obviously, British Steel came about, everything fell into place. We had the music, we had the look, we had the album cover, we had the name British Steel, and we had the name Judas Priest, and the rest is history,
yeah,
really.
It was the culmination of it all. You know, you knew that you had to get out of that. It was a very nondescript period. You know, you knew you had to stand out image-wise, so you had that perfect marriage of sound and vision, you know. And it was almost like what Johnny Ramone used to say about the Ramones. You know, he knew that they needed that same element, that same sound and vision thing happening, where, you know, they had that uniform.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
And it's great that you picked up on that you know, when you did, because everything just gelled, and like you said, culminated on British Steel. It was British Steel and Point of Entry and Screaming for Vengeance and Defenders, and you guys were fucking peaking, man. And
yeah,
it was just, I mean, every album was just, you know, I just sat there in my room and tried to learn your solos. But anyway, that's neither here nor there, man. Like I said, I could just go off, just off the subject of this interview, man. That unmistakable sound of Judas Priest, and with all due respect to Ian Hill on bass, you know, the one constant in Priest since 1969, if I'm not mistaken, with all due respect to him on bass, and, you know, all of the drummers over the years, all 136 of them, it seems to me that the two defining characteristics of the Judas Priest sound, you know, obviously the soaring vocals of Rob Halford and the dual guitars of you and Glenn Tipton. I mean, did you guys basically set the template for that, for what metal guitar became, or what?
Yeah, I think so, because right from the offset, that was kind of the plan. Where most bands in the 60s, they had a lead guitar player and a rhythm guitar player. Well, I just saw the sense in having two lead guitar players, because lead guitar players can play rhythm as well. You know, so it seemed to make a lot of sense to me, you know. And obviously, we could create harmonies and dual guitar parts, but like in a more heavier way, you know, because people think of harmonies, you know, and predominantly harmonies can sound really quite sweet. Well, it depends. They don't have to be. And myself and Glenn designed some stuff that was, you know, not so sweet sounding, and that was kind of purposely, really, so we would fit the songs and stuff. You know, it didn't have to be sweet. Some of it was. So, but we worked hard on that, you know. But to be able to, you know, have a good, solid, distorted rhythm sound, you know, not a clean rhythm sound, because that's what was happening. While, let's say, I was playing lead, was a great thing on stage, because there would seem to be a kind of dropout on stage when I went into a lead solo playing single notes. Doesn't matter how fast you play them. It's not that thick rhythm sound accompanying, you know, fitting that kind of the gap between the bass and the solo harmonically and the texture. You know, there is room for a good distorted guitar sound, and that's that seemed to be fairly obvious to me.
In your book, you're talking about chasing after for years a very particular type of distorted guitar sound. Did you ever achieve that sound? And or if not, what was the closest? If you have to pick one Judas Priest record, what record in terms of, you know, sound-wise is closest to that sound that you were chasing?
I think it was a record that was much later on. I mean, I would say that, and lots of people won't completely understand this, but I think the sounds that we were chasing were more prevalent to later albums, such as Painkiller, for example. But having said that, when I look back and I see the cleaner distorted sounds, if that makes sense, you know, it's because it was always hard to get a quality distorted sound. It was always difficult. We always wanted to have that extra amount of distortion, and it was very difficult to achieve because the gear wasn't really around then. You know, you had to crank your the amp up to absolutely full and use you know, overdrive pedals as well. But then this, it became harmonically a little bit uncontrollable when you used to do that. You know, we were always after a good quality distorted sound at a lower volume, you know, or a medium volume, and that was hard to do. But the benefit is, and the good news is the fact that, during those earlier albums, the rhythm sounds that we did have, being that bit cleaner, gave us very much a kind of unique sound, and it was controlled. And it's very much revered now and respected, and lots of people want to have that sound back, you know. It just meant that we had to play, we had to work harder, we had to work the guitar harder, you know, to do what we were doing. Whereas nowadays, you get a creamy, lustrous, overdriven sound, and the strings feel like butter in your hands. You know, as opposed to razor blades in your hands. You know, guitar players out there will know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I get that.
Well, you play guitar, so you know what I'm saying as well.
Uh-huh.
It's you know, you wanted that overdrive, that distortion that did everything, really, and also was quite forgiving, more forgiving, where the cleaner sound was not very forgiving. And that's why I admire so much, like a lot of bands, AC/DC would be one of those bands, you know, that had the great benefits of sound from those that type of distortion, but really have to work harder. They would know what I mean.
If you could sound dirty doing major chords as opposed to bar chords, you know you're doing something right. I think that was the case with AC/DC and you guys, in a sense that, you know, on Defenders of the Faith, please don't tell me that the opening D chord on Some Heads Are Gonna Roll is a bar chord, right? That's a major D chord, right?
Yeah,
because that is the dirtiest, slimiest, most distorted, powerful D chord I have ever heard, man. And that is the magic of what you and Glenn did.
Yeah, I think there's two inversions of that chord. Glenn's doing one and I'm doing the other, which gave it that kind of overtone. So that's a lot of stuff like that, you know. But if we ever had any luck, I guess we were born and doing this at a time where there was scope for originality, you know, where now the sponge is really starting to get, you know, wrung very dry to give players the opportunity to be more kind of unique, I guess, these days, you know. Gets harder. It got harder for us in Priest, you know, in latter years to come up with original stuff, guitar ideas, you know, technique ideas, and riff and chord progressions, really.
Yeah. Now, you talked a little bit about Maiden in the beginning and your relationship with Maiden. Everything was moving so fast at that period in the mid-80s, where it was just like every 2 years it was album tour, and album tour, and everybody was coming out with albums and doing that whole thing. I mean, were you guys listening to other bands and other guitarists, or were you just kind of doing your thing where you didn't have time?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, I had my own favorites, you know, Budgie, UFO, Scorpions, you know, big time favourites of mine.
Right.
Obviously, Hendrix was, you know, the biggest and best thing. I saw him multiple times, and the guy was incredible, could be incredible, could turn it on and off like a tap, you know, unsurpassed. His ability to be able to improvise always stuck with me, you know. I thought that, you know, and that's a lot of things I never really got that much credit for, was being able to improvise both live and in the studio. Because to me, you know, I always thought the best musicians were the guys that improvise stuff, you know, like jazz musicians and obviously Jimi Hendrix and the likes of him, you know, and great blues players, you know. And I always thought that was the way, you know, that was how you needed to be, really. Because I don't know whether you've ever tried to do it, you know, or to what extent. You have to have pretty good capabilities because, you know, you need to be able to hear what you're going to be playing next while you're actually playing what you're playing, you know. So that kind of...
It makes it a lot less monotonous when you're playing, you know, as opposed to being, you know, in the audience and hearing, you know, not knowing what you're going to hear. It makes it a lot less monotonous and a lot more adventurous if you're the player.
And it's a lot more risky because some nights your sound might not be right. The horn might not sound that good.
That opens up a whole new question, you know, like, you know, a lot of those nights, you know, going to see, and I've seen Priest, close to a dozen times over the years, but, you know, you guys were faithful to the album versions, you know, because those solos were so indelible, you know. It was almost like, how can you tamper with it, you know, because it's so, you know, that the stamp of those solos, you know, Sinner, and just, you know, watching you play Sinner live. But did you ever get to a point where it's just like, oh, you know, enough of this already, just do something else and go off the charts?
No, I think the set solos, I'm in total agreement. If you just set solo in the recording studio, people, and I'm exactly the same, you know, if I go and see, like, UFO, I want to hear Michael Schenker play the solo note for note, because it's like, for example, it's just like the lyrics. People like to sing along to lyrics that they know, you know, and it's the same with solos. You know, people want to hear the solos, you know, the set solos, I think, because they become just etched into your brain, you know. When people deviate from that well-known solo, you know, it's not as good. That's the way I see it, you know.
Yeah.
But I actually improvised certain songs in the studio anyway, seeing A Victim of Changes, The Rage, you know, stuff like that. So I had license to improvise live on stage.
Right. Yeah. You know, like you said, the ones that are well known, and your songs, like I always say, like a really good solo, you can hum. And you can almost sing it as if it's a vocal, you know, and so many of your songs have, you know, that's the case with so many of your solos.
Yeah.
I think the biggest shocker in terms of, it turns out to be your relationship to Glenn, which is seemingly by your account reflective of, you know, Glenn or one, you know, one person gaining more and more power and influence over the band. Which was surprising to me because, you know, again, growing up, you have this image of all for one for all type of thing. You really didn't hear anything on the outside of what was going on in Judas Priest until maybe Rob left around 91, 92. You know, so this was kind of a shocker. Can you speak to that a little bit on your relationship to Glenn?
Yeah, no, for the mainstay, over so many years... You know, our relationship was very good, very productive. We did a lot of things, and we did have a lot of things in common, you know, as people, you know, and musically. And we did the job, and we did it well. But, you know, I think that you get relationships, you know, and it can be problematic, and because there's no two ways about it. It seems to make a relationship work these days, you know. Somebody, it seems to me that one, somebody has to have more tolerance, I think, you know. It's like your mum and dad, for example, who wears the trousers in your family, my family, anybody's family? Is it your mum or your dad?
Yeah.
You know, usually a relationship lasts longer if the one person just accepts that that person's going to wear the trousers.
Absolutely.
You know, as opposed to if both people want to wear the trousers, you know, then you've got a problem. And so with myself and Glenn, I think I gave more than I got back in certain terms, but it wasn't all bad because we were successful. You know, I think I let it slip with the solos and that because, you know, I can play a solo on any song, you know.
Right.
And I can stand up there and improvise all night long because I can amalgamate all of the different scales that you want to throw into the pot, you know, harmonic minor, diminished, augmented, whole tone, half tone, melodic minor, obviously the natural minor, you know, and obviously the natural major, you know, and I can mix all of those scales up, you know, and which helps me to, but I like to think that on top of that, that I've got, I can actually do things with a guitar that are pretty adverse, really, in respect to feedback, whammy bar, pinch harmonics, all sorts of stuff, you know, a technician type of vibe as well. And I'm ballsy enough to be able to just, on a stage, just risk throwing things around, you know. I used to do that. I used to throw the guitar up in the air and catch it again and do acrobatic things, running up and downstairs and laying up. I've done a lot of things as well while I'm wailing away, you know. And, because I always thought that, you know, from the great Jimi Hendrix, what he's playing is fucking great, but what he's actually doing while he's playing that great, that's great too. You know, you put the two things together and there's really some magic there, you know.
Uh-huh.
And not just playing it with his teeth or behind his back or between his legs or whatever he's doing, but all the other stuff like smashing the damn thing up, throwing us around and all of the risky stuff that he would do. Because we're in the arts, it's all about entertaining, you know.
Yeah, sometimes it's just the totality of the art, man, of just creating something,
yeah.
And it's just this everything, the whole package.
Carried away with it. You'll see footage of me on the internet where I've just got carried away.
I have to tell you, it's funny you say that, because 2009, the 2009 tour, which was, I guess, where Nostradamus turns into the 30th anniversary of British Steel, and I saw you guys on the tour in Homedale, New Jersey. And I'm on record with this. I wrote about this. You stole that show, man. And there was something clearly going on. And I remember saying to my friend Tom, who used to go see Priest with me all those years, I said, something's off. Like, you know, obviously Rob was struggling a little bit at the time. Glenn was standing in place. And you were just, you know, surfing the lip of the stage in a way that I'd never seen you do before. And I said, you know, KK is on, man. He's not just on, but he's, like, animated, man. He's, like, interacting with the fans more than I've ever seen you do. I mean, and then I go back and read your book where, you know, there was almost like this thing where, you know, Glenn was almost in competition and doing his thing, you know, in ways that, you know, like, well, what the hell is he doing, you know? Was there a conscious thing, man, going on stage, like a quiet competition thing going on during that tour where you were making an extra effort to be out front where those guys were just kind of just farting around and giving, like, turning in a performance, like, you
exactly
know, basically
that.
Phoning it in.
Yeah, it was, you know, Glenn was definitely more kind of rock and roll than me, you know, before we played and while we were playing, you know, with drinking beers and stuff like that. And I was totally focused, you know. I never ever had a drink before I went on, but I felt that because Glenn was having a beer in between songs, it was slowing things down. Rob was reading his auto cue, it was slowing things down, restricting his performance. And when I to a point on the tour, I'm thinking, you know, if I can up the ante here and do what I normally do and do stuff that we've done in the past, you know, and keep the energy up, then hopefully the guys will tag on to that, but it never happened, you know. To me, it didn't really happen. So it kind of made me back off a little bit in the end, you know, and that's kind of what I started to get disillusioned with. I started to feel kind of odd doing my performance the way that I was doing it. I felt a bit odd, you know. So I kind of backed off somewhat, and that's not what I wanted to do. And I just felt we were, you know, even Ian made a comment in the press. I don't know whether he was trying to get at me, but he was saying that, I forget exactly what he was saying, but he didn't release that comment. It's on Blabbermouth saying that exactly the same things, but things were slowing down, you know, towards the end of the KK era, that our performance was slowing down. And I'm saying, yeah, exactly, and it was. You know, Ian was still doing his thing, what he's always done, you know, but he acknowledges that as well, and that's what was happening, you know. And I just felt that we weren't, you know, we weren't the band that we used to be.
I know there's been a lot of back and forth in the last 6 or 7 months, and you know, you always read about it on Blabbermouth because they love headlines over there. But Ian was recently quoted on the matter of you not being asked to fill in for Glenn after, you know, he turned out, got off the tour for some unfortunate health circumstances, obviously. But, and he said, you know, it wasn't your spot that was up for grabs, it was Glenn's. Now, would it have been awkward for you or just seem weird playing Glenn's parts, or would you have just reassumed your own parts and insist Richie play Glenn's?
I'm a guitar player. Richie's a guitar player. We're all guitar players, playing whatever. We know exactly what's going to happen.
Exactly.
I was in my normal position, and Richie takes over, steps over onto Ken's side of the stage, which is already, Richie's playing my solos and Glenn's. So if I'm there, it's normal that I'll do my stuff. Richie plays Glenn's, maybe some of, you know, and we just become Judas Priest again. I mean, because Richie's playing Painkiller and stuff like that. Richie doesn't have to play Sinner because I can do it better than him, because I am the originator.
Absolutely. The most mind-blowing part of my Judas Priest concert-going experiences was watching you play that on the Defenders tour. So.
I mean, I'm not just saying that. I mean, Richie does it and does a great job. But the thing is, I can play it and perform it better than him, because people will... It will be better for the people because they remember me seeing it doing through all of their lives, for God's sake, which is decades, you know. And that's why it's a better thrill for them to see me doing it than just to see Richie doing it.
Coming from you, it's coming from the direct source where the art came from, man. So that's all the validation you need on that thought.
I mean, you could see me and Richie up there looking and playing and performing pretty damn good, to be fair, because I would make sure that we were ripping across that stage like there was no tomorrow. Say, Richie, I know you can do it, man, and I know I can do it. So we need to present Priest, you know, the way that people recollect, really. It is what it is. It's, the guys are on tour now with Deep Purple, and they're going to be out there with Ozzy in the UK next year. So it is what it is. That's where it's at. But Ian, that was the silliest thing I think I've heard Ian say, really. You know, I mean, I'm not going to step up there and play Glenn's. I mean, would I be interested going back there? Was Richie playing my part and me playing Glenn? I'm sorry, but no, the answer's no.
That's exactly what my thought was when I read Ian. And I'm sure you've heard, you know, I'm sure it's been mentioned to you if you haven't read the comments, but it was basically coming from Ian's assessment that it wasn't your job that was up for grabs, it was Glenn's. And I was just like, well, that's, you know, I can't see KK playing Glenn's part. He's just going to take his own fucking parts if that were the case.
I would contest this. You know, the Andy, and I love Andy, and he's great, and I consider him a mate, and I've been up to his studio, and, you know, and Andy's great, but the thing is, you know, I still think that I would, even if that happened, do the people want to see Andy playing Glenn's parts, or they'd rather see me playing Glenn's parts?
Yeah, you want to put people in the seats, too, you know, because let's face, you know, I'll be honest with you, man, you know, for the same reason I got off the train for a few years there, you know, and it was because of Rob, and I got off the train when you left, man. You know, there's just like, there are key elements of, you know, I went to see Epitaph, man, but that was, you know, people are going to get off, what I'm trying to say is that more people are going to show up if KK's on stage, you know, and
I'd like to see.
you know this, I know everybody knows this.
Yeah, because the people, they want to relive. And I'm the same. I'm exactly the same. You know, if I go and see a band now, let's say if it's UFO Scorpions, I want to see the original band members. You know, I really do. I want to see them out there for as long as I possibly can, if there's an option.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we all go back remembering the days when we first saw the band, and, you know, that's what we pay the ticket for. One thing's for sure, the name and the legacy and the songs are bigger than individuals, but it's only fair to the audiences, as long as people can, is to give them as much as of the original members, because that's really what a part of the ticket and,
yeah,
and the journey time that they travel, you know, paying babysitters, whatever they have to do, you know, it's all a part of the price of the experience.
Regarding... there were, again, there was like a lot of going back and forth in the press over the past year, you know, and as far as those guys appreciating you or not appreciating you, or realizing, you know, what your contribution to the band really was. You know what, man? We know it. The fans know it.
That's very heartwarming to hear you say that, Mike. Honestly, it really is, you know, good man for saying that. It's very reassuring. You know, I just, the one reason I did the book is I'm just sick of those guys trying to kind of bury me through the internet. It's unfair, and I don't know what the deal is. You know, it's stemming from somewhere. You know, it's heartbreaking to see that going on. You know, it's unfair, really. It's unfair.
I'm glad the book is out there. I'm glad you're finally getting your voice outside of your voice in Priest. And if you don't feel that your voice was, you know, you had much of a say in Priest, look, man, you left your fucking mark, man. It's in those grooves on the records, and it's ingrained in my childhood, man, and in my fingers,
yeah,
trying to play your solos, saying, what the fuck is he doing here, man? You know, it's the mystery, man, the mystery and the magic and the whole, like Bruce Springsteen says, the ministry of rock and roll, man, and your contribution is indelible. So just know that. Just know that from a fan's point of view.
That's great. As I say, sometimes we often said as musicians, we can often be blind where the fans, you know, have got clear 2020 vision. You know, and I'll say that when we're in the studio, you know, we're working on a song that probably shouldn't really be on the album, or we're doing an album that really shouldn't probably be, you know, that could be better for the fans. But, you know, you get blinded sometimes in what you're doing, and I think some of that's going on, has gone on with the band since I left, really. They kind of think, you know, that what they're doing and the people is right for everybody, you know, but sometimes that can creep in. But anyway, Mike, I'm going to have to jump on this other call if it does come in, but you're more than welcome to, if you want some more time and have a chat with me. I'm here all the time, mate. No, it's not a problem, mate.
Great.
Just let me know. We can hook up again. I've doubled up with a couple of guys that have been calling in, because time goes by so fast, you know, mate. But let's leave it there for now.
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, man. Yeah. If I knew Jan Wenner personally, I would have had a sit down with him about 15 years ago and ripped him a new asshole for why you guys aren't in a hall yet. But that's another discussion, man.
Okay, mate. Well, like I say, the invite goes out, mate. I'm here. Just let Lisa know, you know.
Yeah, I would love to do that with the new show when we go on.
No problem, mate.
We'll have a
no
much different angle, and it'll be great, you know. All right, KK, I'll let you go, sir. Thank you, man. I appreciate your time.
Cheers, Mike. Yeah, love you, mate. Take care.
Take care.
Bad news keeps pouring on me, bad.